This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The 2016 legislative season ended early, sort of. House Speaker Shep Smith had put it out there publicly that he wanted to end on Saturday. And in the end, a generous assessment would say they wrapped up on Friday night. Technically, since it was after midnight, it was a Saturday adjournment, and it was certainly quite late by the time the speeches, backslapping, and goodbyes were over, and lawmakers could lay their heads down. Before they left, Speaker of the House Shep Smith delivered an earnest closing message to his colleagues.
I think about the fact that we can resolve our differences here, that this is the place, this is the people's house where the people of the state can come and petition their grievances and be heard.
Well, there are some people with grievances about how key issues were handled in the last few months at the State House. Regardless, we now know the ending of nearly all the work legislators did during this biennium. There's a chance lawmakers will need to return for a special session, depending on what happens with the idea of purchasing hydro dams along the Connecticut and Deerfield Rivers. Three of the reporters who also had a very late night on Friday are joining us today to tie up all the loose ends and to analyze the most important political issues that were addressed this year. Reporter Terry Hallenbeck with 7 Days. Hi, Terry. Nice to have you here.
Hi. Thanks, Jane.
And in our Montpelier studio, VPR's own Pete Hirschfeld and Kyle Madura of WCAX Channel 3. Pete, Kyle, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here, Jane.
Thanks for having us.
Pete, tell us what it was like on Friday night as the session wrapped up in the dark hours just after midnight.
You know, there was a little bit of wistfulness to it. There are a lot of people in that building who were saying goodbye to the State House, people that have been there for decades in some cases who are calling it a career. There are also four very high up people, the governor, lieutenant governor, House Speaker, and Senate President, who are either not running for office or are seeking different elected offices next year. So it was a changing of the guard, the end of a legislative era, and I think there was a lot of introspection about the work that had been accomplished and the role of the institution very generally.
Terry Hallenbeck, did it feel poignant with all those people leaving?
Or? You know, at the end, I thought, wow, this is a pretty big moment. These guys are all leaving. This might get really emotional. And then it kind of did and kind of didn't. Like, they each give a separate speech, although the governor did a joint address, which is unusual at the end. But it kind of felt like it lacked that sort of real oomph that I thought it was going to have.
But is that just a journalist speaking? You wanted the
perhaps.
Drama.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what drama I was expecting, but
Kyle, did you feel any sort of excitement in the chambers?
Absolutely. If only the excitement to go home. I mean, it was almost a tale of two chambers in that you had the Senate, which had really concluded much of its work by 6 o'clock-ish, a little bit after that. And then they were just sort of waiting for the House to finish up its work. And they did several roll calls as the Republicans sought to get the Democrats on the record, whether it was voting on the budget bill or the tax bill or the fee bill. So you had much more of that laid back, goodbye, nice seeing you sort of feeling over in the Senate. And in the House, it was kind of that last final sprint. They really were working right up until it was time to transition from the work to the pomp and circumstance of it all.
Well, listeners, you may not have stuck around until after midnight on Friday night, but I know many of you have been paying attention to all of the legislation as it moved through the chambers this session, and I'd love to hear what you thought. Did lawmakers largely get it right or wrong on the issues that needed to be addressed? Are you okay with a study commission on marijuana legalization? Do you like the energy siting guidelines that allow for more community input on solar and wind installations? Are you still celebrating or grumbling about paid sick leave? Call 1-800-639-2211. Our number again is 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. The state budget was one of the last pieces of legislation to pass, and the vote was deeply partisan. Let's hear a little bit from House Republican Minority Leader Don Turner on the floor.
We have a structural budget problem with the state. This is not the way to fix it. We need to start bending the curve on spending, and we haven't done that.
Turner says the spending plan outpaces Vermonters' ability to pay for it. General fund spending will go up nearly 4% next year, but revenues are expected to rise by less than 3%. But Democratic House Speaker Shep Smith defended the budget.
Well, many of the critics of the budget never put forth any alternatives about how to cut anything. And, you know, it's easy to criticize. It's actually hard to do.
Smith says the budget supports public infrastructure, education, and social services without burdening Vermont households. Terry Hallenbeck, do you think that's true?
I think it's true that budgets are hard to do, and it is true. All of those things are probably true, that it does not cut curb spending the way they sort of promised to, but that's hard to do, and viable alternatives were not really forthcoming. So I think the Republicans will really use this, you know, Don Turner explaining his vote on the floor. I think a bunch of other Republicans did. This will become an election issue for them. And they'll have some traction on that.
But is this just a case, Terry, of Republicans like Don Turner being able to say, this isn't how I would do it, but, you know, not having to back that up because they don't have the power to make those changes, and Don Turner not running for higher office here, so he doesn't have to then come up with a plan, even though he has said a couple things that he would have done differently. You know, do you think there is a feasible way to do this without raising fees and taxes?
Oh, I think it's tough. That's what it comes down to is payroll goes up, expenses go up, and they did not have really, you know, I think the Republicans are just too much of a minority to come up with their own plan. But, you know, I think they did promise that they would sort of restructure the way things are funded, and that didn't happen.
Peter Hirschfeld, any big takeaways that people should know about the budget bill? This is a more than $5.5 billion budget. What do people need to know?
For the most part, it keeps the train running on the same rails that it was before now. Some small increases for the state colleges. There's some more money for the Department of Children and Families, for opiate addiction treatment infrastructure. But largely it keeps state government in sort of the same form and functions that it has existed for the past 5 years. And, you know, there's Don Turner argues there, look, we're spending more than Vermonters can afford. We're seeing general fund growth, which is the portion of state spending that lawmakers have the most control over, rise faster than the rate at which revenues are coming in. He argues this is going to create a structural problem. You're going to hear Republican candidates on the campaign trail this summer and fall saying exactly the same thing. But, you know, Democrats say, look, we've made commitments. If we're going to honor those commitments, we have to pony up the cash to do it. And that's sort of the dividing line between Democrats and Republicans right now. And I think there are a lot of Republicans who feel like the promises that have been made are more than the state can afford to keep.
And before we get back to the politics there, as you were mentioning, Pete, there one of the ways that the government is raising some extra cash this year and trying to avoid having to put that on the shoulders of taxpayers is through mutual funds. Can you just explain how that works?
Yeah, so mutual funds are charged fees, and as are some of the broker-dealers that manage those. And so the state figured out a way that it can raise $24 million by increasing fees on both the funds themselves as well as the brokers. And the general thought is this is not going to hit very many important constituencies in the state of Vermont. I asked Don Turner about this, and I said, hey, look, they're saying great way to raise money, mostly from out of state and from large mutual funds. And Don Turner said, you know, I don't necessarily disagree with the merits of the mutual fund fee proposal. It's what you do with that money that I have a problem with. And instead of using it to offset tax liabilities elsewhere in the state, we're instead using it to feed our appetite for more spending.
Kyle Madura, when it comes to the budget bill, you know, this year felt to me like there was very little discussion out in public about the big money bills, and yet it took till the very last minute to get it passed. From your perspective, really looking inside the halls of the chambers, did it feel to you like a contentious budget debate?
Yes and no. I feel like the overarching principle that a lot of the budget writers were looking to pull off this year was to really get away from the use of one-time money, which is something that they've largely relied upon in recent history in order to balance the budget. And Representative Mitzi Johnson, who chairs the Appropriations Committee, said, look, we want to make sure that one-time cash is put towards one-time uses and not to recurring problems so that we can get ourselves to a stable platform in years moving forward so that we're not constantly coming back looking to drive up more common taxes and fees than they really relied upon this year. I mean, Pete mentioned that they leaned heavily on the mutual fund fee. They do have a provision within the tax bill that will look to get rooms and meals taxes off Airbnb rentals. But much of those taxes that would actually affect the general population or fees that would affect the general population were really pretty minimal sources of revenue here.
So you heard, though, Terry and Pete both mentioning that this is something that we're likely to hear about again on the campaign trail as the summer and fall ramp up. Does Phil Scott, Kyle, need to be cautious about what he says in case it comes back to bite him should he become our next governor and has to put forth his own budget?
Well, he's certainly talked about making sure that Vermont deals with the so-called affordability crisis, and it's going to be an emphasis there. I think he'll be quite close to the perspective that Don Turner outlined in saying, look, where we've got this new revenue, we probably should have made some other things cheaper. He's talked about trying to put Health Connect onto stable ground. He's talked about possibly transitioning to the federal exchange. I think that's something he'll talk about a lot as a potential cost saver moving forward as Vermont continues to struggle to get a perfectly functioning exchange. I don't think he'll go quite as far out on that limb as Don Turner did, but I think he will make economic issues the plank in his platform, not just a plank in all likelihood, because that is an area where the Republicans have been getting traction and really hearing from constituents. So it'll be fascinating to see just how far he pushes that argument moving forward.
If you have a question about the legislative session or you want to share your perspective, again, our number 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. John's calling in from Stratford. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Hey, for the last 4 or 5 years, we've had a budget gap each year where they pass a budget and then find out that revenues don't meet the expenses. This past April, we had a $16 million shortfall in revenue. The legislators in this session did not address that. Are we going to have another big budget gap next year?
John, thanks for your call. Terry Hallenbeck.
I think, you know, that's something they would fix in July with a budget adjustment act if revenues fall short, and that could definitely be a problem.
And I think that the budget that they pass now, the legislative analysts are projecting that we're going to be looking at a $30 million general fund gap in fiscal year 2018 when lawmakers come back next year to figure out how to take care of that problem. So even at this early stage, they are projecting that there will be a difference between the cost to keep the state government we have going today in fiscal year 18 and the amount of revenues that will be coming in that are going to be needed to support that budget.
But moving up to July when the next fiscal year begins, Justin Johnson has argued, the Secretary of Administration has argued that, look, $16 million, we've got enough wiggle room in our budget potentially that we can just sort of put off some projects. We can move money around, possibly pull from surpluses elsewhere. They argue it's manageable, and some say, look, we don't know if this is a one-month blip or if this is going to be a continuing trend. So if it's a blip, they're in pretty decent shape. If this trend continues, it's going to take a much more radical approach to close that.
So the budget bill obviously must pass legislation every year. Something that wasn't must pass legislation, but certainly seemed like it felt that way, was marijuana legalization. And that long debate over whether or not the state should legalize pot really picked up steam in the last couple of weeks. In just a couple of the recent twists and turns, House Minority Leader Don Turner proposed holding a statewide referendum so voters could weigh in on whether or not Vermont should legalize. That approach didn't sit well with Representative Allison Clarkson. Here is Clarkson and Turner from that debate last week.
We are elected to represent our constituents. We are elected to make tough decisions. That's our responsibility.
You guys want to know if Vermont wants it legalized? Put your money where your mouth is. Vote for my amendment.
Well, the idea of a referendum failed, and next, lawmakers debated a House-Senate compromise plan that, among other things, would have decriminalized growing two plants. Representative Chip Conquest argued that a limited grow-your-own approach would mean that people can get their marijuana from a legal source. Representative Marsha Martell disagreed. Here's some of that debate.
We've said that those people need to enter a criminal realm. They need to get it from someone who is committing a crime. And that doesn't seem to me a very rational way of setting up the system.
Human nature is to always want more. We allow two plants, then they want four. Before you know it, everyone has their field of dreams in their backyard. What a great example for our young generation to grow up with.
Decriminalizing the cultivation of two plants also failed, as it turns out. And in the end, only one piece of the plan survived, and that was a special commission to study legalization. So we began the session with a substantial report from the Rand Commission on legalizing pot in Vermont. We end it with a directive to, what do you know, study legalizing pot in Vermont. Terry Hallenbeck, how disappointing is that for people who really were pushing for legalization, including Governor Shumlin?
Well, pretty disappointing. But actually, they didn't agree to the commission. What they because Senator Sears, in the end, on the Senate side, just said that I don't need a commission. but they did agree that a joint legislative committee is going to meet six times over the next few months, the rest of the year, to discuss.
So no commission, just
no
a committee.
No commission, just a committee.
But we're still going to be discussing, not
yes,
studying.
Yes, we will still
Got
discuss.
It.
But no, I think, you know, we went into this debate knowing that it might not pass, and it didn't. So that's not stunning. I think what's surprising is sort of some of the gaffes that happened along the way. I mean, supporters of this really did not cultivate, so to speak, House members over this. Like they weren't, a lot of House members were reluctant, and there was really no indication that anyone tried to groom votes in that chamber.
Why not?
Or if they did, that they didn't succeed.
Yeah, why do you think they didn't?
Well, I mean, I think there was some effort to do it, and it just didn't fail. It just didn't pass. It didn't take hold. Mm-hmm. But there were also a lot of House members who had said they were reluctant. And I think senators and the governor were just sort of afraid to pick at that scab. And what they really should have been doing was trying to educate them, if you put it that way, of here's why we think this needs to be done. And a lot of the testimony that senators heard, it was way later in the process before House members even started hearing it. And I think they finally got them to sort of realize that prohibition has failed. That's the terminology that people are now adopting. But no House members, or not enough House members, really went farther than that.
You know, when we come down to it, though, one of the feelings seemed to be, we've got to get this to pass. We've got to get this to pass, from supporters. Kyle Madura, although supporters of legalization are clearly disappointed, you know, you saw a tweet from David Zuckerman right after debate ending saying, all right, well, legalization failed. Let's all go get a drink, you know, trying to point out some hypocrisy here. So they're disappointed. But does the state really lose anything by not moving forward this year on legalization? I mean, it's not like if Vermont doesn't legalize it this year, it doesn't get to in the future, or doesn't get to collect any revenue in the future. So it seems like this will sort of just come back onto the agenda, no harm, no foul. Is anything not right about that, Kyle?
No, it's certainly going to crop right up again next year. And I think when you consider the legalization bill that the Senate had put forward, where folks would be able to purchase marijuana from a retail outlet known as a dispensary, what's interesting is that within the Senate proposal, the date in which both sale and possession would become legal was January 2nd, 2018. So it's perfectly possible that if lawmakers really do hear more about the issue and become convinced of its merits in time for next session, it's possible they end up going forward with the same enactment date. Now, I think that's unlikely, but that it was pushed out into the future. So it's not like this was right around the corner had they said yes. The other interesting element from advocates' perspective is, while they may not have gotten their legalization or decriminalization bill, they did push forward a pretty substantial change to the state's medical marijuana law, which adds glaucoma as a qualifying condition, and it also adds chronic pain as a qualifying condition. And what's interesting about the chronic pain condition is that it's a much looser standard than the current of severe pain. And that means someone perhaps with really horrible arthritis might be able to qualify. This is a condition that in other states led to de facto legalization in states like California, Colorado, Montana, others. Now, the difference between what we have here in Vermont and out there is that Vermont's law does require a substantial patient-physician relationship to be in place. But this change could potentially greatly expand Vermont's medical marijuana registry roles and add far more people, and may actually have a greater impact than decriminalization would, for instance, because who knows how many people would have actually said, yeah, I'm going to grow my own, rather than continuing to go to their black market dealer and just knowing that if they stay under an ounce, they're still in decrim territory and not really facing a substantial penalty.
Interesting stuff. If you want to share your thoughts on discussing marijuana into the future now, you can call 1-800-639-2211. We're going to talk about more stuff coming up as well, everything from bicyclist safety measures to banning questions about felony records on first-round job applications. And you can share your thoughts on legislation that passed or legislation you wish had passed on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Or again, 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at the legislative session that wrapped up on Friday. We're examining some of the new legislation that will soon be going into effect, if it hasn't already, and what got left behind. We're also looking at a changing of the guard in both the House and Senate as Shap Smith, John Campbell, Phil Scott leave their leadership positions. Call 1-800-639-2211 with your questions or comments, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, reporter Terry Hallenbeck with 7 Days, and Kyle Madura of WCAX Channel 3. And let's go to Eli calling in from Burlington. Hi, Eli. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much, and thank you to the guests. I think it's been great to read all of that, listen to all of that great reporting coming out of Montpelier this session. I just wanted to add on quickly about marijuana and the possible ways forward here. You know, one thing I've written about is I think that we should open up the cap on dispensaries so that these new patients can be having a little bit more variety in their own choice, and also to allow some of the business capacity to build. I think that's one thing the Senate understood, is that there is a will for people to get into this business, and I think doing it in dispensaries that are better regulated is a great step. On top of that, if we really wanted to do something smart and prepare ourselves for the future, we could look more at our state marijuana reciprocity laws and be allowing more out-of-state patients to come to Vermont and access these new dispensaries and existing ones with their out-of-state cards. We know tourism can be a big part of the market, so I think that's a way where we can get started on all of these things. So thank you very much.
Eli, thanks for your comments. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Tim in Warren. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hello. Just a couple comments. One, I believe the budget is out of control, and we have to bring the spending under control because we keep spending too much. Two, referendum voting, I would like to see that come into the state. I would like to see an amendment like that pass because that gives voters more of an opportunity to give their voice. I mean, the elected officials are in there, but a lot of times they don't listen, and they're pretty much in there for life. So, like, I'd like to see a referendum vote on term limits of our representatives, because when you have Bill Doyle, he does a good job, but frankly, he's getting old, and, you know, you got to bring in new blood. Then as far as the marijuana goes, I'm glad that it didn't pass, because the way that it was written and the way that it was going to be implemented, it really wasn't going to get rid of the illegal drug trade, so to speak. And it's treating it more like heroin than basically like beer and wine. In the state or federal regulation, a single person can brew 50 gallons of beer and 25 gallons of distilled spirit, you know, and it's okay. But then here the state wants to have you register, pay a fee, wants you to grow indoors, which then that creates more greenhouse gases and more electric use, which we're having trouble supplying the state with electricity at this point. So I think there needs to be more discussion, and I think when Zuckerman's first bill was introduced, that's what the state should go towards, more of a friendly path opposed to treating it like heroin.
Tim, thanks for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Peter Hirschfeld, I want to pick up where Tim was commenting on his support for a referendum style of participation in Vermont. We don't have a system like California's where you have voter referendums and they become law. So part of the debate on marijuana was, should we have a non-binding referendum to get a better sense of what voters are thinking? Tim saying, I'd like to see a referendum on other things, term limits. I'd like to see voters have more input. You think there's any traction for that?
Well, Vermont's constitution is very much by design in the fact that it does not allow for those sorts of binding referenda to occur, except under some really exceptional circumstances. The bar is very high for that to happen, and a lot of people think it makes for a better system of governance so that you don't have a new amendment to your constitution every year based on where the will of the people happens to fall at a given time. As for the non-binding referendum idea that Don Turner floated, it was funny. There were a lot of Democratic operatives that were just foaming at the mouth at this idea. Don Turner had initially said, let's do this during the primary election. They later suggested, well, hey, let's do it in the general. Why not? There are data crunchers who have found that binding referenda of this sort have a massive impact on turnout among left-leaning young voters, particularly those between the ages of 18 and 29. And so Democrats saw a real opportunity to give the party a lift in November by having this referendum. They could not convince lawmakers of the rightness of that approach in Montpelier.
Terry wrote in to say one of the undercover disappointments of the session, the failure of the legislature to create an ethics commission. It's long overdue in our small state where conflicts of interest are far too common. And, you know, this really was a big subject of debate between 2015 and 2016 in the middle of the biennium. Kyle Maduro, what happened?
Well, I think you found that at least in the Senate, senators were not convinced that the commission would have enough real power to accomplish much. There was also the concern that it came late in the session, didn't give folks enough time to truly consider it. Now, the Senate did pass a few rule changes surrounding disclosure and ethics generally, and the Senate is regarded as having the power to essentially police itself. So they do have some elements there. They kind of picked up where off of some of the House's rules surrounding ethics. But the commission really lagged behind, and it came at a time where senators didn't really think it was going to do all that much other than perhaps play traffic cop, direct. They basically receive complaints, direct it to the proper authority, and basically be this go-between that folks could use. But they didn't see a pressing need for it. They like to think of themselves as an ethical bunch, and they weren't sure that they had the time to properly consider it, and they weren't sure that the commission would really have true functional power. So those at least are the reasons they gave for why they found themselves unable to move forward in that regard and instead went with rule changes.
Let's go to Jesse calling in from Rockingham. Hi, Jesse. Hi, Jesse. I can hear you breathing. Man. You there?
Well, I'm real happy that the effort to expand Dr. Dinosaur is now given a path to succeed. Now there's funding to study it, and those prospects are good. And we need a good victory in healthcare reform. I think it has been Vermont's greatest success in healthcare.
Jesse, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Terry Hallenbeck, Jesse, they're referring to Dr. Dinosaur, the program for healthcare for young people in Vermont. And there's been a conversation about expanding that, expanding not only the ages of young people who are eligible, but also expanding it to all children, regardless of income. You want to expound on what Jesse's talking about?
Right. And so they did agree to spend a little bit of money to study expanding the age limit of Dr. Dinosaur to 27 so that you can delay your growing up in one more way, I guess. But so I think the supporters of that saw that as a victory that, you know, as the caller mentioned, it's a path forward. So it's $100,000that went into the budget for that.
And to look again at whether or not the program should expand to all children regardless of parental income as
right.
well to try to cover more Vermont
right.
children.
It's to sort of make it universal health care for young people 27 and under.
And Joe is on the line with us from Marshfield. Hi, Joe. What are you thinking here as the session has come to a close?
Hi, how you doing today? I just wanted to say that if you wonder why candidates like Donald Trump and stuff like that are getting the people's attention is because legislatures and government is so out of touch with what's really going on out here. You know, you drag your feet on this marijuana thing forever and ever, and, you know, the police are so worried how they're going to bust people. There's something that impairs you for about 20 minutes, then you're fine after that to drive. It's just ridiculous, and I think that the government's really out of touch with what's going on, and that's why the phenomenon of Donald Trump and of these other people is coming. Have a good day. Thank you.
Joe, thanks for your call. Joe, disillusioned with all government and looking at how what we're experiencing in Vermont might be reflected in national politics. Appreciate your call, Joe. Let's talk about another big issue that came up this year, and for some at least, that was the legislature's attempt to make sure that communities have a say in solar and wind projects that are cropping up within their boundaries. Kyle Maduro, what's the legislative conclusion on how to do that fairly, how to let communities have a say?
Well, this was the deadline deal Friday. It's an issue that took the conference committee, which is a group of three representatives, a group of three senators, well into the afternoon to sort out. And I don't know that anyone left that committee truly happy. In fact, it took one of the representatives another hour or so to cool down before he ultimately signed on to the plan. And basically what it does is it allows a community to craft its own renewable energy plan, come up with areas where they could be comfortable with some of these larger scale renewable energy projects being within their communities, but they also might be able to specify, look, we don't want it on our ridgeline, or we don't want it in this area of town because it's a precious place to us. And so these towns would be tasked with coming up with their plans. There is some money for experts to come in and help the locals draft those plans, because obviously many of these communities where we've heard the most outcry are not large communities. They're small communities in the mountains of Vermont or elsewhere, not necessarily, say, Chittenden County. And so then it would need approval by a regional planning commission. And if that is to happen, any projects that would come before the state for approval moving forward would need to be in line with this plan to a degree. There is an allowance within it that would allow state interest to still overcome any regional plan, but substantial deference is the term that's used, and that would be given to the local plan. So it's not a straight-up veto power, but it's fairly close if they've imagined a lot of the possibilities moving forward and done so well and in a clear plan that's approved.
You know, Peter Hirschfeld, when we had the chairs of both the House and the Senate Energy and Environment Committees on Vermont Edition to discuss this bill earlier in the session, Senator Chris Bray told me that he had never had a bill where no one seemed happy after the version that the Senate had passed. He said he didn't get a single compliment. He said, I don't expect a parade, but I expect at least somebody to be happy. And then Representative Tony Klein told me everybody was happy with what he and his committee was doing. So as this bill ends, everybody happy or not?
No, everybody is not happy. There are some people who live in the shadow of what might be some wind turbines erected in the Grafton Windham area and the Swanton area, who were trying to use this bill as a mechanism to regulate the sound standards that those prospective developments are going to have to abide by. That's the issue that was really holding things up at the end. And Peter Shumlin had indicated to lawmakers that he was going to veto the entire measure if they forced those developers to abide by sound standards that had yet to be written. But I think what you saw the House do, sign on to giving towns whose plans are certified by the Public Service Department substantial deference when it comes to deciding where wind and solar projects are going to be built, is a nod to the outcry that lawmakers are hearing from municipalities, from people in areas where these solar and wind projects have been put, that they have a legitimate claim that they have not had enough say in the process to date. And this is a law that has the capacity to have some real substantive differences in the way we as a state decide where energy projects will be built. And I was talking to Chris Bray. I said, you know, help me put this into context. You guys have been fighting over this year after year after year. Is this going to solve the problem? And he really thinks that this is going to be regarded as our energy equivalent of Act 250, that this will be the regulatory standard that finally threads that needle between allowing the state to realize its renewable energy goals without making towns feel like they're getting stuck with projects that they don't want.
And just piggybacking on what Pete had to say there, I think when we see both the emergency rules and the final rules written for the sound standards, that's when people are either going to be happy or sad. The advocates for this law were saying, look, we think there needs to be a decibel level set. I believe they were talking about largely below 45 decibels. And I think the developers will say, you know, below that, we don't really have evidence of medical issues. So I think the final weigh-in from those on both sides of this issue as to whether they won or lost will be when the emergency rules are written, coming up in a little bit, or when the more importantly, when the final rules are written in the summer of next year.
Lots of legislation that was on the table this year. We're getting to some of it. You can share your thoughts on the ivory ban that didn't pass, the gillfeather turnip as the new state vegetable. You happy about that? Are you a gillfeather turnip fan? You want to talk about voter registration or the legislation that requires employers to leave off a section about whether you have been convicted of a felony on a first-round job application? And what legacy does this group of retiring politicians leave? Some very powerful voices in the legislature retiring or moving on, they hope, to other things after this session. Share your thoughts with us, 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking with reporters Terry Hallenbeck from 7 Days, Kyle Madura from WCAX, and our own Pete Hirschfeld. They're helping us debrief the end of the legislative session, what passed, what didn't, what's going to be studied or, excuse me, discussed, marijuana, over the summer, etc. And you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note about what you think of this year's legislation at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Now, for the last 3 legislative sessions, the same 4 men have held the top political offices in the state. We're talking about Governor Peter Shumlin, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, House Speaker Shap Smith, and Senate President Pro Tem John Campbell. All 4 are now leaving their offices, either for the private sector or to run for other offices. But that changing of the guard was remarked on plenty, especially in the last week or so with going away parties, roasts, endorsements. On Friday night, Governor Shumlin said this in his end of session address.
You know, tonight probably represents the biggest transformation in leadership in the legislature, in state government, in the greatest state government in the country of any time in recent history.
All right, so Governor Shumlin there remarking on what he sees as a very large historical moment. And it's not just those people we mentioned. There are some other big voices and personalities in the State House like Tony Klein, Diane Snelling, Patty Comline, who won't be back next session. Terry Hallenbeck, how different is it going to be, or how big a deal is it? I mean, you know, Governor Shumlin saying this is a very big moment in history. Do you think it is?
I think it is. I think, you know, I think he struggled with the exact wording, as I will here, of is it historic? It's historic in some way. Is it unprecedented? Well, I don't know. But it's a huge shift. These are people that everyone got used to. These are the people in charge and sort of got used to their personalities and their pensions, what the sort of things that mattered to them. And now it is an open field. And we don't know who will be the next governor, but we don't know. I mean, there's just a lot of change going on in the State House. It's not just legislators, but some, you know, lobbyists. Alan Gilbert's leaving. You know, we rely on him
for ACLU
stuff. It's going to be a wholesale change in the building.
Kyle Madura, what do you think that means then? You know, a wholesale change in the building, this is a new opportunity for some people, I suppose, but also a real loss of institutional knowledge.
Certainly. I will say that whoever replaces these individuals, especially within the legislature, will likely have worked hand in glove with both the Speaker Pro Tem, John Campbell, as well as Representative Shep Smith, the Speaker of the House. A lot of the leadership on the Democratic side in the House is expected to potentially vie for that role. I think you will see largely a continuation of the Speaker's style. It's one that was respected not only within his own party, but across the aisle with both the Republicans and the progressives. So I think you'll likely see a continuation there. In the Senate side, there are a few names hanging out there. I think the one that has been seen as the most likely might be Senator Tim Ash. That would be an interesting move. It will be interesting to see how he would run the office if indeed that happens. He has been leading the Finance Committee, which has had an interesting cast of characters over the years, and has been noted as being able to bridge some of those divides. Obviously, the most interesting element is the governor's race. I mean, you will see a fundamental difference not only in what's pitched from the fifth floor if there's a changing of the guard, but you may see if someone like Phil Scott emerges or if Bruce Lisman emerges as a Republican governor, you will see a fifth floor that's not aligned with the interests necessarily of the House or of the Senate, because I don't think you're going to see Republicans take over either chamber. So that perhaps has the most potential for really changing how our state government operates.
Let's go to Emily calling in from Putney. Hi, Emily. You're on.
Hi, Dane. And hi, Terry. Thank you so much for taking my call. I want to hark back to the discussion about the referendum, not specifically about the marijuana referendum, but about the potential of having referendums. And the Commodore said that there was many who were happy with the Constitution the way it is, that negates any popular referendum. And I would suggest that the view of the government or the legislature in the House may be very, very different from the people, and certainly BPR is pretty well cued into the views of the House and the government. But I do believe that it was very brave to suggest that we have a binding referendum or even a non-binding referendum, but we do need a referendum mechanism for the people to engage government and to no longer just be servants of or minions of the government. We need to be able to exert our will as a collective in new ways. So,
Emily, I hear you. Let me put that to Pete Hirschfeld. What do you think, Pete? I mean, we've had a couple of listeners sharing their support for a referendum in today's show.
Yeah, they may be right. Maybe that is the proper way to run government. The counterargument that people make to that is, imagine if we had put gay marriage to a referendum. Would same-sex couples be allowed to marry their partners today had that gone the referendum route as opposed to legislative action? And the sense is that when you leave certain issues to the will of the majority, you risk outcomes that in hindsight might appear to be less fair and less measured than the ones that you get through the legislative process.
Lots happened during this session, if you look at it in one way. That ban the box legislation on felony convictions passed, voter registration passed, an electronic privacy bill passed, the ivory ban didn't, neither did divestment, but we do now have paid sick leave, cyclist safety, drivers should give cyclists 4 feet when passing, it's in the transportation bill, and we have a new state vegetable, the gillfeather turnip. So overall, Terry Hallenbeck, a productive session or not?
I really think it was one of the most unproductive sessions I've seen. And I really think it's because of what we said, the departing lawmakers and leaders. I think they spent a lot of time on things like independent contractors. Like a committee spent almost the whole session on it and came to no resolution. And so that issue remains unresolved.
This is if people are miscategorized as independent contractors.
Right, defining who should be an independent contractor, right? And so I just think that a lot of people had one foot out the door.
You think that's why it was an unproductive session, because people had their minds elsewhere?
Yeah, I think that is probably what it came down to. I think some of these issues are tough to solve also. There's no question about that. But I think that there's, you know, there's, their minds were elsewhere.
Well, some of these legislators won't be back next session. Hopefully all of our guests today will be. VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, reporter Terry Hallenbeck with 7 Days, and Kyle Madura of WCAX Channel 3. Thanks to all three of you for recapping the session with us today.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
And that's it. Now it's registration season for preschools across the state, and parents and teachers are gearing up for Vermont's universal pre-K law going into effect in July. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll check in on this big change to the education system and how it will work. Send your questions or comments about universal pre-K to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.